Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Hamnet. The new Chloe Zhao feature is out. Big drama, Will Shakespeare, life and death and big questions. 2 hours of it, all combined with Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal's performances made for something really special. We took a look at it. We're going to tell you what we thought. We're also going to take a look at Jay Kelly over on Netflix. Yeah, this is that new George Clooney movie people have been talking about. People are saying it's best performance in years. Also stars Adam Sandler, Laura Dern. This is a Noah Baumbach feature written and directed. Excited to talk about it. We're going to take a look at what's going on with Netflix and Warner Brothers and Paramount. it's kind of a whole thing. If you don't know about it, we will give you the inside scoop. And if you do know about it, you might just learn something. So stick around. We're going to talk about that in the middle of our show. Stand by for that. Before we get to everything, we need to take a look at the news. The big story this week, outside of the Netflix, Paramount, Warner Brothers thing that I said we're going to talk about in just a minute, put a pin in that. We're going to come back to it. The Golden Globe noms. Big Golden Globe noms are out. A lot of snubs. Gonna be a lot of snubs this year. And while we're not really big on the Golden Globes here on Off Script, these are typically a bit of a predecessor for what may be coming down the line with the Oscar noms of the year. So, you know, maybe not bad to tap into. Let's talk about it. Andy, how are they looking this year? One movie is leading the charge, right?
That's right. One battle after another leads the most nominations in the film category. The Golden Globes, of course, do both film and TV. For a long time, they've been a bit of a joke. A lot of times their picks were wildly different from the rest of the awards season, particularly the Oscars. This year, it seems to be more in line with what we'll see the rest of the awards season, which is officially starting now and will go into March or whenever the Oscars are. The Golden Globes are going to be hosted by Nikki Glaser this year, and they're on January 11th, so just about a month from now, so really quick turnaround. We're going to try to get in through these categories because there are a lot. Here are the nominations for Best Motion Picture, Drama, Frankenstein, Hamnet, It Was Just an Accident, The Secret Agent, Sentimental Value, and Sinners. And I'm also just going to go ahead and do the other category, Best Picture, Musical, or Comedy, Blue Moon, Bugonia, Marty Supreme, No Other Choice, Nouvelle Vague, and One Battle After Another. A lot of movies. The categories are weird, but what are some of our thoughts?
First off, I love seeing One Battle After Another get a lot of attention. Also, I know Sinners got a lot of attention this year, which is a good time. I think people were afraid that, Coogler was going to be forgotten about come award season. Good to see, at least in the gold, but that's not the case. A little surprised to see some names on here. I did not like Frankenstein quite as much as everybody else did, but I know some people were really warm on it. Additionally, like, Begonia is one of those movies that's always funny to see in, like, musical or comedy because it so doesn't quite feel like either of those, but it's not quite a hard drama either. It's got to be something. And One Battle also hanging out in musical or comedy feels a little weird. I would have figured that would be drama, but it is quite a funny film.
It's strange that One Battle After Another and Sinners, they feel like they're in the wrong category. Sinners should be in the musical or comedy section, and One Battle should be in the drama section. Like, they're not, like, traditional comedies. Same thing with Begonia. Begonia is a very dark and very bleak. It's a pitch black comedy. Some other notables, Richard Linklater has two nominations, two different films, which are Blue Moon and Nouvelle Vague, which we haven't seen. Nouvelle Vague, I think, is actually on Netflix now. Maybe that's one we'll watch soon. So strange, but these are shaping up more of what we can kind of expect to see come Oscar season.
Yeah, let me hit Best Picture. Let me hit Best Animated Picture real quick. I'm going to be honest, some of these I definitely don't know, so I'll hit it fast. Nominees for Best Motion Picture at the Golden Globes are Arco, Demon Slayer, Infinity Castle. Just going to skip the big part of that. I don't know how to read. Elio, K-Pop Demon Hunters, Little Amelie, or the character of Rain, and Zootopia 2. Additionally, non-English language, I also don't know a lot about, was It Was Just an Accident out of France, No Other Choice out of South Korea, The Secret Agent in Brazil, Sentimental Value out of Norway, Surat in Spain, and The Voice of Hind Rajab in Tunisia. I'm going to be honest, I haven't seen most of these, but we felt like it was important to touch on. Of what I've seen, I think K-pop is probably my favorite, though apparently Zootopia is killing the box office. We'll talk about that in just a second.
Yeah, the big snub here is Naja 2, which is the Chinese film that's made over $2 billion, the highest grossing film of the year. No one's even close yet, and it's not on here. It's a very Chinese film. It has not been really marketed to the West, and so that's probably why it's not on here. It Was Just an Accident is probably going to win Best International, or one of the one of the contenders for that. That is the film by Jahar Panahi from Iran, who has kind of made that film in secret. We've heard a lot about it. We'll talk more about it when that's out. But the non-English language stuff is, we've heard great things about. Sometimes the international stuff comes out and you won't have heard of any of the pictures, but we've heard a lot about these throughout the year.
That's true. I remember Secret Agent with Wagner Moura out of Brazil. Yeah.
Moving on to Best Actor, Drama, and I'll just do drama. Gosh, these are organized so poorly.
Yeah.
Joel Edgerton for Train Dreams, Oscar Isaac for Victor Frankenstein, the proper Frankenstein, Dwayne Johnson for The Smashing Machine, Michael B. Jordan for Sinners, Wagner Moura for The Secret Agent, which I've just heard is a really great movie.
I've
been hearing great things. Jeremy Allen White for Springsteen, Deliver Me from Nowhere. That's a surprise to me because that movie's been pretty poorly received, lukewarmly received.
Yeah. Favorite pick for me, I think, is probably Michael B. Jordan, Sinners. He's got to play two characters. I really like Joel Edgerton and what he's doing in Train Dreams, but I know it was a short shoot and it was a small budget. Sinners just seems to be a little bit bigger. And maybe Moore will get some love as best actor in a motion picture. Best actress, real quick, in drama, Jesse Buckley for Hamnet, Jennifer Lawrence for Die My Love, Renee Reinsva for Sentimental Value, Julia Roberts for After the Hunt, Tessa Thompson for Hedda, and Eva Victor for Sorry Baby. It's Jesse Buckley with the bullet, baby. Everybody get out of her way. It's her year. Andy, what do you think?
Yeah, Jesse Buckley is going to take all the awards home this year, probably. Jennifer Lawrence has a great performance in Die My Love, which we also might consider watching.
Yeah.
But that movie hasn't been very warmly received. Renata Reinsve in Sentimental Value that we talked about from last week, really great. Julia Roberts is the big surprise here for After the Hunt. That movie, again, kind of didn't land. Tessa Thompson, we haven't watched Hedda, but this has been getting a little bit of buzz, so not surprised to hear. So you're on here. Ava Victor for Sorry Baby. This is also a big surprise. This is kind of the little movie that could this year. Very small indie that's been doing real well, showing up on top 10 lists and things like that. Best Actor, Musical or Comedy, Timothy Chalamet for Marty Supreme, George Clooney for Jay Kelly, Leonardo DiCaprio for One Battle After Another, Ethan Hawke for Blue Moon, Lee Byung-hun for No Other Choice, and Jesse Plemons for Bugonia. Man, I think the front runners here are Timothy Chalamet and Leonardo DiCaprio. That's going to be like neck and neck. Who knows who's here? That's the old Hollywood versus young Hollywood. I'll say I got to go for Timothy Chalamet. You know, dream big.
Yeah, dream big. I actually really like George as Jay Kelly in Jay Kelly, which we're going to be talking about here towards the end of the show. Stick around for that. Also, I hear Ethan Hawke is great in Blue Moon as Lorenz Hart's kind of balding, small man who's hanging out in a bar the whole movie. But yeah, if I had my way, Chalamet probably. Best actress in a motion picture, musical comedy, Rose Byrne for I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Cynthia Erivo for Wicked for Good. Look who's turning up, all right? Cynthia Erivo for Wicked. Kate Hudson for Song Sung Blue, Chase Infinity for One Battle After Another, Amanda Seyfried for The Testament of Anne Lee, and Emma Stone in Bergonia. Dude, stacked category this year. Absolutely stacked. I really hear Rose Byrne's doing something special, and if I had legs, I'd kick you. I haven't seen it yet, but I keep seeing clips on Twitter, and she's just kind of flying off the screen. Although I do like Chase Infinity a lot, and I do like Emma Stone. What do you think?
So this is the year of brutal motherhood pictures. Hamnet is one of those. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is one of those. Die My Love is one of those. I've heard Rose Byrne is doing incredible things in this role. Well, we didn't talk about this earlier. Wicked kind of snubbed for Best Musical or Comedy. Again, Wicked Part 2 has just not been as warmly received. It's going to be close. It's kind of, I think the supporting categories are where it's a little bit more kind of up in the air. There's no like clear standout from these. Do you want to jump ahead to Best Director?
Yeah, we should. Go ahead.
Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another, Ryan Coogler for Sinners, Guillermo del Toro for Frankenstein, Jafar Panahi for It Was Just an Accident, Joachim Trier for Sentimental Value, and Chloe Zhao for Hamnet. Of these, I mean, it's if it's the One Battle After Another year that everyone says it's going to be Paul Thomas Anderson. After that, it's a little bit of anyone's game. I mean, Chloe Zhao has already won for Hamnet, or for Nomadland. So who knows? But the front runner is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, it's going to be Paul Thomas Anderson. I think if it's not him, I'd love to sneak it over to Coogler. Like, everybody else is great, but Sinners really is something special, and I hope it gets its flowers somewhere. You know what I mean? Best screenplay, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another. Josh Safdie for Marty Supreme, Ryan Coogler for Sinners, Jafar Panahi for It Was Just an Accident, Joaquin Trier for Sentimental Value, and Chloe Zhao for Hamnet. I think it's probably... Probably Paul Thomas Anderson. Although, admittedly, like, the scripts for Sentimental Value and Hamnet are quite devastating, man. Like, and I haven't seen Marty Supreme yet.
Yeah, I've heard that Marty Supreme is really pretty spectacular. It could be kind of a late front runner, but it's not out for another 2 weeks, not out until Christmas. Apparently, it's surprising that Josh Safdie was not under the best director category, but he is here. So we'll kind of have to see. Again, another could be Paul Thomas Anderson year. Best original score, Alexander Desplat for Frankenstein, Ludwig Göransson for Sinners, Johnny Greenwood for One Battle After Another, Kong Ding Rhee for Surratt, Max Richter for Hamnet, and Hans Zimmer for F1. I don't know. Hans Zimmer is a sneak because that F1 score is not that great.
Yeah.
Of these, I think Sinners is probably been my one of my favorite scores, but again, it's probably going to Johnny Greenwood for One Battle After Another, who probably should have won in 2007 for There Will Be Blood and didn't win then. He's definitely very deserving of that.
Yeah.
So, a year of great scores.
Sinners has a lot more music for sure, and I remember really being warm on that when I saw it, but I've seen One Battle After Another a couple times too. I don't know. That really could go either way. I think I like the Greenwood score a little bit more, but I don't know, man. One more I think we're touching on here. Cinematic and box office achievement. Categories include, or nominees include Avatar, Fire and Ash, F1, K-pop Demon Hunters, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, Sinners, Weapons, Wicked for Good, and Zootopia 2. This one's a funny category. This was added, last year? This is kind of... You know, get in some of the popular ones that maybe aren't getting any direct awards, like Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, and Weapons, which we don't see represented a lot here. Zootopia 2, obviously, getting a nom. And hilariously, Avatar Fire and Ash, which has made no money because it hasn't come out yet. But I think it's just assumed that it will. Andy, what do you think?
This category kind of makes no sense. You would assume it would just be whoever makes the most money, but it's not. Kind of, you have something like K-pop Demon Hunters, which is a Netflix film, so it made no money, so it can't be completely about the money, but that movie has had a big cultural impact. This is sure. Basically an award that's made up, and you can give it to anyone for any reason. It's real unclear what the criteria is, and like I said, some of these movies aren't even out, so it kind of doesn't make sense.
Mission Impossible practically lost money. Don't I have that right? Like, didn't that movie?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I say, if Tom Cruise comes, give it to Mission Impossible. Have Cruise get up, give a speech. Everybody love it. If Cruise is not at the event, exactly. If Cruise does not come, don't give it to Mission Impossible. That's it. If you can get a Cruise speech on a big stage talking about the power of cinema, worth it. Absolutely. Give it away. But if not, I don't know. What do you think? Golden Globes. I mean, good, bad, ugly. Where are you at?
They're definitely getting better and not being a complete joke for that. And they give us an insight into how people are leaning and who the front runners are going to be. The big money is saying that One Battle After Another is basically going to sweep all the awards. It's like the Oppenheimer year where it's just like you knew from September that Oppenheimer was going to win everything, and so it's not very interesting. It's more interesting when it's a lot closer, or you have like a three-way tie or four-way tie from that. So again, it'll be interesting as more awards start in January, February, and to March. It's a crazy like 6 to 8 weeks before the Oscars.
Yeah. Let's see. It looks like the Golden Globes will be on broadcast on CBS and streamed on Paramount Plus on January 11th, 2026, from 8 to 11 Eastern. We will cover them here on the show. So if you don't have the chance to watch them, or you're not subscribed to Paramount Plus, or I don't know, just maybe aren't too interested, keep it on all scripts. Subscribe to the show, and we will have the results for you later that week. We always cover the stuff, and we will let you know what got awarded and what didn't, snubs, all that stuff. Keep it on off script for more. One more thing to talk about before we get to Hamnet. We're going to talk about the box office this week. Man, I feel like people did not like Five Nights at Freddy's 2, but then Five Nights at Freddy's 2 made a lot of money. So it leads me to think that people actually liked it. What happened, Andy?
Another big win for Blumhouse. Five Nights at Freddy's 2 came in at $63 million domestic and $109 million globally. Off to a great start. The previous movie, the first one, made a ton. And this is why we'll continue to get these kind of crazy IPs winning at the box office because people just like him and has a large built-in audience. I don't really understand the whole that movie at all. I just know it's super successful, but that's not as near as impressive as Zootopia 2, which came in second, $43 million domestic, $915 million worldwide, nearly $1 billion in 2 weeks, almost unheard of, $430 million of that from China. Like we said last week, big hit in China. Really crazy. I can't believe that it's made that much money in such a short time.
Five Nights at Freddy's, the first film, has a 33% on Rotten Tomatoes, and Five Nights at Freddy's 2 currently has a 13%, but audiences don't seem to care. Andy, are we doomed to consume slop? Is this where the American audiences are headed, where like just the worst crap will get, I don't know, we'll sell tickets because people will feel like they're in on the joke? I mean, what's going on here?
Slop for the slop god.
Slop for the slop. It is, man. It's slop. What are we doing? Why are we eating slop?
I mean, it's an audience driven business. If that these are the movies that resonate and that people will go out and pay for, you know, we've talked about how anime and these manga series have also been super super popular, which is also surprising. Those are all rated R, which I only learned this weekend. Like the Demon Slayer movie and the Chainsaw Man movie, rated R. Like young kids can't get in. So I was surprised that they weren't PG-13 ratings, but very successful. So it's rough. But another win for Blumhouse.
Yeah.
Moving on to the rest of the box office. Wicked for Good came in third with $16.7 million domestically, $440 million worldwide globally. It's doing well, but it's slowing way down, especially compared to the first movie. And it's slowing down in a lot of ways, both at the box office and, like I said, awards and all that stuff. Is also that talk has kind of evaporated as well.
Yeah. It is really funny that like these animated features are killing it and they're all like rated R. I was just reading here, G-Kids, new anime pick, Jujutsu Kaisen Execution, came in fourth in North America with an estimated $10 million. It's called Execution. It's an animated feature. It's amazing. They're just getting like more horrifically violent with each turn and people keep turning out for it. It's really funny. Like how awful, what kind of awful thing can we put on screen to get people to pay to get a ticket? It's really funny.
Yeah. Someone was asking me if their kids could go see the Chainsaw Man movie by themselves. And I was like, oh, sure. It's got to be PG-13, right? And they're like, no, it's rated R. Will they let my kids in? I was like, oh, yeah, probably not. Not if you're not there with them. Rounding out the top five is Now You See Me, Now You Don't, the third film in the Now You See Me franchise with $3.5 million, $209 million worldwide. Again, slop for the slop god. Because that movie's been very successful off the... Yeah, there's a crowd. There's a crowd for it. There's an audience for it that's been, three of these are just like, oh man, it's
rough. This all feels like tender ground to start talking about Netflix and Paramount and Warner Brothers and what else. But we're gonna talk about it in the middle of the show. We're gonna get to it. All right, we're gonna talk about Hamnet first. Any other thoughts in the box office before we jump into it, Andy?
You know, the stuff aimed at kids and families are what's really working. The Zootopia killing it at the box office, and also just the kind of the fandom of Five Nights at Freddy's also continuing to do really well. That movie was made for $36 million, so they're already way in the green, or way in the black for that, and it's only week one, and you know the holidays are coming up, people are going to watch it and rewatch. So yeah, it's definitely been a little bit better box office than earlier in the fall.
It's so funny that like, I don't know, movie studios are like slanting these like big budget projects towards like families and children, and those are like exactly the audiences that can't afford to go to the movies right now. Like people like families with a couple of kids are like, it's too expensive, we spend $130 getting tickets and food, and that's like exactly what's coming out to theaters. It's like, come see Mario, come see Zootopia 2, right? Like that's what's getting sold in a place where people, like the audience it's being sold to, can't afford it. Like it's very obvious that like young people are going to the movies, right? Especially with the success of these R-rated animated features. Like we're not getting, you know, 13-year-olds, but we're definitely getting 18 to 25-year-olds. Like that's who's turning up to these things. That's who's turning out to stuff. But I don't know. Like, movies are just in this funny place where it costs a lot to make things, and we got to make things that are going to be a sure hit. And so that's going to be slop for the slop gods. And that's what we're going to be making. I didn't mean for this to be as cynical as it came off. We should move into Hamnet. I should stop talking about this and save this for Netflix, Paramount, Warner Brothers. So, sorry, it's been a long week for your movie loving friends. Let's get into it. Andy's gonna be taking the summary on this, so I will get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
Hamnet. So this is the follow up film from Chloe Zhao, who Oscar winner for Nomadland, Best Director, Best Picture, several years ago. A bit of a bleak film that I didn't really connect to or get into, but she did win. She went on to do Eternals after that for Marvel. That film not very well received. But she's back with Hamnet. This is based on a historical fiction novel by Maggie O'Farrell, who also helped write the screenplay. It is about the writing of the play Hamlet, the famous play, after the death and tragedy of Shakespeare's son, Hamnet, the name of the novel. Although the novel is, or the story we're told, is a little bit different from that kind of premise that we're given. The story centers around Agnes, played by the great Jessie Buckley. She is a woman of the forest. She loves nature. She loves to be out in nature. She knows about medicine and just where she likes to be, to the chagrin of her family. She meets a young man that's tutoring the children on the farm she works on, named William Shakespeare. They meet, they fall in love, they start a family. All this happens very quickly, but it's about the building of these relationships. It's about the love of between these two people, but also the love of family, parents, children, brothers and sisters, that sort of thing. And the things that they love as well. William Shakespeare himself is frustrated by life in rural England. He wants to be in the city, in London, writing plays. Same thing with Anya. She wants to be in the forest all the time. She gives birth in the forest. She wants to. They have to like keep her from running out there all the time. But it's a story about grief and loss, and remind me a lot of Sentimental Value, of healing through art. Lots to talk about. Zach, what do you think?
So I think Hamnet is great work from Chloe Zhao and Jessie Buckley and Paul Mescal. Everybody in this is a lot of fun. It is humble and small. It's a small cast. It's a small budget. But it's got very lofty themes. And I think the script is at times genuinely emotionally devastating. Like it is hard. Not a dry eye in the house in parts of Hamnet. Like it is so challenging and deep and asks a lot of its audience. But I think that also makes it difficult to recommend, because I don't know who I can ask in my life to sit through 2 hours of this and like what, how you're going to feel coming out on the other side. Like you're gonna have a deeper connection to the world around you for sure. But also like, man, it's heavy. It's heavy. And there's a lot of pain in Hamnet. So let's talk about it. First off, Jessie Buckley, I think we should talk about performances. Jessie Buckley is amazing. Is Agnes. She is going through so much in this movie. Like, She is a character who does not fit in the world around her. She finds comfort away from town, away from the village, in the woods, like on her own. And when she meets Will, this tutor, like, and they had this immediate spark of connection, like something that is undeniable. Like they very quickly realize that they are absolutely made for each other, and they just, I don't know, things just feel right. It's the way it's meant to be, fate or destiny or something. He's got this wonderful speech early about Orpheus and Eurydice and how the two of them are kind of similar to that. And that gets echoed through the movie as they develop this relationship. A lot of this lands in the trailer, like that you've seen for this movie, that I think most people have seen this movie. The problem is like much of the movie is in the trailer, I think. And it hurts kind of the plotting and the pacing, because most people going into Hamnet kind of have an idea of where it's going and where the drop is going to come out from the roller coaster. And once it gets into Act Two and you start to get into these really heavy themes with these kids and pain and the plague and pestilence, like it's hard, man. It's a hard watch.
Yeah. I've definitely told people about it and they've been like, oh, I don't think I'm going to see that.
Yeah.
But the performances are stellar. Jessie Buckley has to do such a range. Like she carries the film largely herself. You know, there's these intense like scenes of loss and grief, but also highs of love and marriage and birth. And it's running the gamut of human emotion. She's incredible. Paul Mescal also, I didn't realize that he was going to be as good as he is in this as well. People are talking that he might get a supporting actor nomination. We have top-notch performances. By the end of the first act, I was like, give the Oscars to everyone in this film. It's really stellar. And yeah, because it's historical fiction, you know a lot of what's coming. You know that the play that's going to be written, and you know why. It does avoid like the real annoying thing of I'm reminded of Wicked for Good, that tried to really shoehorn the Wizard of Oz stuff in there real clumsily. This avoids that. Like, we get hints of William Shakespeare, but it's not about him. It's about her, and it's about their family. You get a little bit of him, you know, writing a line to Romeo and Juliet, or his kids playing and echoing the three witches from Macbeth. The film is not interested in his character. It's just kind of there as the backdrop for the very kind of powerful ending. So I like that it wasn't too focused on like shoehorning the William Shakespeare stuff in there.
Yeah. It's not like the movie opens with like, it doesn't open with any text crawl that's like, William Shakespeare goes on to be the greatest play ever, but before you knew him, this is the story. Like, that's not really what's going on. Like, they don't even really mention that he's Shakespeare until a ways into the movie. People on Twitter have been making this great joke where like somebody in their theater goes like, I knew it when they say Shakespeare in like act three. I knew it was Shakespeare the whole time. Like, I think the movie kind of expects you to understand what's going on here. It respects your intelligence and expects your emotional ability to process kind of this great loss, man. Like, it's real heavy. And I really appreciate the way the movie recontextualizes Hamlet, right? Like, because I studied Hamlet in college. I took a Shakespeare course because I went to a stupid liberal arts college, and now I have a movie podcast that I do. And like, it naturally, we spent some time on Hamlet. I remember doing a scene of it in college, and like, I think I read it in high school, like an abridged version of it. Like, so I've spent some time with Hamlet before, and I have an understanding of the story and kind of the characters in it. But I lacked some understanding behind like the context of the plague and how much that affects the story and how much that affects these characters. I think it's really cool that by the end of the movie, when you start to get into, you know, where this play is going and the play that you're familiar with, you come to it with new understanding. And the movie definitely avoids being too Shakespearean by not just using Shakespeare language throughout the whole thing. Most of his prose is just limited to performances in the world where characters like Noah Jupe will be playing an actor who is playing, like, we're doing a Shakespeare scene, or his kids are running around in a field doing a scene from like Macbeth, right? Like, otherwise everybody talks pretty normal. You're not trying to listen to Shakespeare the whole time, like, which is nice and a kindness, and that makes that stuff more meaningful when you get to like his like proper writing.
I wanted to also mention about performances. The child actors in this are amazing. Like, incredible. I was like, I can't believe that like they're getting kids, like 10-year-olds, to act out like really complicated scenes. I got to cry on command. The Jacob E. Jube, the real life brother of Noah Jube, plays Hamnet, the young son, which is really important later in the movie. But the child actors are really incredible in this as well.
Yeah, you're right. Zhao gets great performances out of the kids. I'm not sure exactly how she manages to do it, but it's fantastic. And it's a nice return to form for her. Like, her last movie, I think, was Eternals in 2021, right? And then since then, she's done like a couple music videos. She did a thing for Diablo 4. She directed a cutscene for Blizzard in their video game in 2023. Otherwise, like, this is kind of her first swing back at it. It's genre, it's historical, it's different. It's good, man. It's a good return to form for her, and I'm looking forward to seeing what she does next. As far as awards contention goes, like, I think The Grace has been kind of shown where it is. Buckley is getting a lot of attention for her performance. Otherwise, you don't hear a whole lot. Like, I know, Andy, you'd mentioned the soundtrack was particularly moving. I can't hum much of it, but I do remember it coming in heavy towards the end, man. Like, for sure. It definitely earns its place in the third act.
Right. So I wanted to talk about that. So it's scored by Max Richter, which I enjoyed the whole score from the very beginning. But at the end comes on a very famous piece that he's written called On the Nature of Daylight. And you will have heard this piece used throughout TV and film, because it's very good. It's used at the end of Arrival, kind of the climactic end of that film. It's also used in The Last of Us in the Long, Long Time episode with Nick Offerman. When you want a real emotional gut punch, that's when this the score kicks in. So I was surprised to find that he did the entire score, not just that last piece. It also looks beautiful. Like I said, it's very much a lot about nature, and there's this whole thing with doorways and kind of crossing over. It's real brilliant stuff. It is heavy subject matter, and I'm not someone who really cries a lot at films. I remember people saying that Train Dreams was really devastating and sobbing, and I was like, I was fine through that. I was not fine through this. It was a question of like,
yeah,
are you going to cry? It's how many times you're going to cry in the movie.
Yeah, man. And I think that's what makes it a challenge to recommend. So we should get down to it. I think, Andy, would you recommend Hamnet?
I absolutely would. I think this is one of the best films of the year. It's going to be in contention for all the awards stuff. Performances are incredible. It's an incredible telling of this story of family, of love, of grief and loss and healing through art. It is heavy stuff. It deals with the death of a child and the emotions along with that. And people have told me that they're not interested in that, which is totally fair. But I would highly recommend it if you can overcome that hurdle.
Yeah, I think it's a really good film, and I think it's a tough watch, and it can be both, right? Like, we've talked about these on the podcast before. God, we've talked about Zone of Interest, which is like an amazing movie. Who can I encourage to go see that? You know what I mean? It's heavy and challenging. We talk about like eat your vegetables kind of movies, and maybe this is one of them, man. Like, this stuff is like stirring for the soul. It's really good for you. Zhao is doing great work here. Buckley deserves all of the praise. She really does. An incredible performance. Mescal's fantastic as well. But it's heavy, and that's okay. It can be devastating and challenging, and that's okay. But yeah, that's Hamnet. It's a good time. It's small. It's humble. I think the hype is a little heavy. Don't go in too hot. Don't think Hamnet's going to be Best Picture winner. I don't think it's really what's going on here, but like, it's a really solid entry, and it's a good return to form for Zhao. And that's Hamnet. Man, we got to talk about this Netflix Paramount thing. Good God. What do we call this segment, Andy?
It's time for the death of cinema. So late last week, if it's either Thursday or Friday, news hit that Netflix had won the bidding war to purchase Warner Brothers. This doesn't mean it's a done deal. It's a very complicated process, but this basically means that they've entered private talks with just Warner Brothers and just Netflix. And of course, they have to agree on a deal, and then it has to get through the regulators. This usually takes like 2 years. It's a long process. So it's even longer to then start seeing the new ownership actually start making movies and TV and all that. But some details here. Netflix offered over $80 billion, $28 per share. The share price is going to be important here in a second for Warner Brothers. They are specifically only wanting to buy the streaming and film business, which is WB Studios and HBO basically, and not the what's called the linear TV business. They're not interested in CNN, TNT, TBS, HGTV, the Discovery side of WBD. There's also this $5 billion breakup fee. If the deal falls through, Netflix still has to pay Warner Brothers $5 billion. So that's kind of encouraging that if it doesn't work out, you know, they're still going to earn some money. A lot of big questions, though. What happens to the theatrical model? What happens to HBO? Does HBO just get sucked into Netflix, or do you keep the prestige TV and have their own tile? Who knows? A ton of questions going on. Zach, what do you think?
If you have any film people in your life, people like Dr. Draper and I here,
send them flowers.
Yeah, dude. Like if you haven't talked to them at all about this, maybe ask them and just be like, hey, what do you know about this Netflix Warner Brothers Paramount thing? And if they're tapped in like we are, man, they'll probably be pretty blue about it. Like, and that may not make a lot of sense, because I know a lot of times we talk about studio stuff on the show and it's lofty and it's like, okay, the guy who runs HBO is adding Discovery Television to it. So what, right? Like, it seems far away, but like, this has a lot of big implications, and I just want to make sure we highlight those in case you miss them in some of the complicated language. Like, The number one biggest streamer in the world, Netflix, is buying the number three biggest streamer in the world, HBO, and everything that that includes. And the number two biggest streamer, right, the one in between them, is Amazon, which is really only like partially a streaming service. Like, they're mostly like a retail business that have a digital arm. And like, that's fine. It's irrelevant. But the point is, like, these are very big moves, and Netflix is kind of the king of, we don't want to put stuff in theaters and we don't want to put stuff on physical media. And HBO, meanwhile, is usually pretty kind to release stuff on Blu-ray, and Warner Brothers, which HBO is a part of, is big on the theatrical experience. So Netflix acquiring all of these assets makes it seem a whole lot like it's in their best interest to stop putting stuff in theaters and to stop putting stuff on Blu-ray and to put stuff on Netflix and make HBO a tile over there, and then just increase the price of Netflix $11 a year for the next decade until we're back at a cable subscription for $200 a month, right? Like, it just feels like this is like the parting of the Red Sea or something. Like, we are witnessing a very large event happening very quickly. And the implications of that are quite frightening. And we know it's a big event, not only because these two big properties are involved, but it's a big deal, dude. $82 billion. I don't even know where Netflix gets that kind of money. They can claim $9 billion in revenue a year, but it's going to take a whole lot of, you know, monkey business and counting beans to make that add up. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, the biggest question is the theatrical releases. Netflix famously thinks that theaters are outdated. They think, you know, the consumer just wants to sit home and watch like entertainment on their couch, and we want to make that happen. They have claimed that they, quote unquote, expect to keep the existing release theatrical releases that Warner Brothers has already contracted for. That's probably true. However, there's no reason for them to continue. And there's this great quote here that from Ted Sarandos, who's the CEO of Netflix, says, I think over time, I think the windows will evolve to be much more consumer friendly, to be able to meet the audience where they are quicker. So the theatrical windows already shrunk after the pandemic. They went from 60 to 90 days to 30 to 45 to as little as 17 if something's a real flop. Superman went to the streaming service, not even VOD. It went to the streaming service in 30 days from release. Crazy. And maybe something that we can expect to see. So people are saying, even if they do release things, it's going to be something in theaters for a week, maybe 2 weeks, and then on Netflix. And maybe that's where things are already going. Some people are saying Netflix is just accelerating what's already happening, and that's the death of theaters. So it's rough. And who knows? Who knows how they're going to treat these? We really don't know. Someone was saying that Netflix is kind of tapping out their subscriber. They have 300 million subscribers. So who knows how many more they can really get. So they're going to have to start looking in other areas for revenue. And for instance, someone suggested that HBO might be an add-on, a paid add-on. It's not actually included in Netflix. So we don't really know how it's going to go.
Yeah, I think the pie in the sky kind of moonshot hope for those of us who collect Blu-rays and like going to the movies every week is that Netflix is acquiring all of the assets to continue producing content and produce new content in that model. Even though Netflix personally does not have a lot of big connections with movie theaters, Warner Brothers does. And by merging with that, like, they will inherit a lot of goodwill and avenues for distribution theatrically, right? So maybe they will. Like, maybe we'll get more of like Stranger Things season 5 finale coming to theaters, that kind of thing. Like, definitely potential for sure. And they are inheriting the structures to do that. The same goes for Blu-ray. Netflix does not have a lot of resources for printing and shipping their own physical media, Blu-rays, 4Ks. With Warner Brothers, they do. Like, they have like warehouses and factories that they are getting, you know, like, that is connections. Like, that is a big part of that. So maybe they will, right? They, by acquiring Warner Brothers, they are acquiring the tools and the tool sets and the workshops to make those things happen. But historically, we don't have any evidence that they'll do that. That's kind of the problem, right? Andy and I just covered Wake Up Dead Man, what, last week or the week before? And like, yeah, we had to drive to weird theaters across town. It's only in theaters for a couple weeks and then it's gone. And like, notably, that video is kind of underperforming for us, probably because not a lot of people have seen it because it's in theaters and not on Netflix where it's going to go. They don't promote. they make funny decisions. Speaking of Wake Up Dead Man, I was just complaining last week that I can't get Glass Onion, the second film in the Knives Out trilogy, because they never released it on Blu-ray or 4K. It doesn't exist. They never printed a copy. So I can watch it on Netflix or get it nowhere else. Netflix is kind of historically anti these things. So while it's cool that they say that, hey, we want to keep releasing films theatrically, we want to keep doing this stuff, it seems like all but an inevitability, short of them changing course big time, that they're just going to do it for a short amount of time, then stop and go back to what they are doing, you know?
There was something I had heard is that movie going might become more like concert going, where people don't go to, you know, big expensive concerts every weekend or every month. They usually go to a handful. You might go to four or five, you know, expensive concerts a year because of the price. And so that's kind of what's happening with theater. I can see a world where Netflix releases pure hits in theaters, like K-Pop Demon Hunters 2, whenever those sequels come out, because you know that's going to be successful. But what's not getting a theatrical release is those kind of middle of the road films, those mid budget films that you don't know if it's going to be a hit or not. Something like Weapons, which was a big hit, but you don't know that beforehand. So I think the things that are less IP driven, less known, are probably just not going to get theatrical distribution because it's safer to just put it on the streamer. So I think that's what we'll see more of.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like that's the one other thing. I think Netflix historically does not give content a chance. They will greenlight a season of a show, it'll come out with a few episodes, and they will swiftly cancel it before it gets a season two. And this is notably in contrast to stuff on Netflix that has grown organically, like The Office, a show that like really found its footing like after it premiered on television. CBS had this with Star Trek, for God's sake. Star Trek was not popular when it premiered on television, but rerunning it over and over and putting it on streaming services and like running it late at night all injects it into the culture. People start to get it and make memes of it and share it. Netflix had this with The Office. Like, they don't traditionally do stuff like that. So like letting things organically grow is not something they seem to be invested in either. Like, dumb Ted Sarandos wants everything to be more consumer friendly. Anyway, really quick, what is with the Paramount thing though? Because Paramount still wants a piece, right? They think they can still get in on this. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. So this morning, Paramount launched a hostile bid that they're calling it. They countered with a $108 billion bid. This might seem like more money, but it's actually not, because they are offering to buy the entire company, Warner Brothers Discovery, which means both the streaming and movie business and also the TV business. So it's actually less money per share. It's $18 per share as opposed to $27 that Netflix is offering. Complicated business stuff that you can ask your finance majors about, but they're trying to counter offer aggressively and say, no, you got to listen to us too. Who knows? The president chimed in on this too. Everyone's talking about it. And this is all done, like the way this is financed is through huge loans, and you go to big investment banks and different like hedge funds and things. Like Jared Kushner's hedge fund is involved in one of these things. So you get like you put together like 5 or 6 or 10 loans to get $108 billion. That's how all this stuff is financed. They don't just have the money in the bank. So it's real ugly. It's going to get uglier. Another hot take I'd heard is that this kind of freezes Warner Brothers, because they've entered into these talks. They can't really make any new deals, like the kind of deal that Ryan Coogler got for Sinners to get the rights after 25 years. They can't greenlight new things. They just kind of have to hold. And so in a way, it allows Netflix to freeze out one of their competitors for at least the next 2 years.
Yeah, the third biggest streamer, yeah, which would be a direct competitor with Netflix until they acquire them. I don't know if there's any champion here. Like, that's the other thing. Say it goes the other way, right? Say somehow this doesn't go through. It does seem like some insane financials. I've definitely seen people online say, no way this Netflix deal actually happens. I don't know. Maybe Paramount does end up getting the keys here in a week. Who knows? I don't know if Paramount's much better. Like, Paramount can claim that, oh, it's about the theatrical experience, right? We respect putting theaters and films. I saw something about them saying they were going to put 30 movies in a theater like every year. They were going to swear by it. Sure. But also, like, they're getting their money from weird places, namely, like, Saudi Arabia and like, you know, Jared Kushner and, like, Trump shaking the tip jar, you know what I mean? Like, and it's just like, I don't like any of that. I don't like any of that stuff, all right? That all looks bad, too. That's not good. So, I don't know. I don't know if there's any... It doesn't seem like there's any winners here, man. It seems like we're all losers. But I can confidently say, I don't also think this is like, I don't know. I was listening to this argument Sean Fantasy was making on the Big Picture podcast. Andy encouraged me to check that out. It's a great show. Should go check that out after this. And he was talking about how, like, this isn't really Netflix's fault either. Like, you could say they're like the ones brewing the storm here, but also like they're riding the wave. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't make all this happen. This is like decades of studios acquiring studios and Disney grabbing 20th Century Fox and, like, just, you know, like, entities eating each other to get us here. And none of that is good.
Yeah, it's also interesting to note that Netflix's competition is, it's not the studios. It hasn't been the studios for a while, or theaters. Their biggest competition is YouTube. That's who they look at as their other, when people, you know, I do this when I work, I put on a YouTube video kind of in the background. Netflix doesn't want you doing that. They want you putting on a show, putting on content that they have. So that's their competition as they see it. It's none of the movie stuff, which is funny.
It is funny. God, what a crazy thing. What's ideal situation for you? How could this settle out that you would feel good? Is there a world where that's a thing?
I mean, there's really not one. Netflix is probably slightly better than Paramount getting it. There's a lot of kind of questionable earmarks with the TV and news market involved with Paramount. But it's kind of everyone loses all around.
Yeah. One thing's for sure. You know, the properties will be fine. No one's going to ruin Batman. I don't think anybody's got it out for DC. Like, that's not really a thing. I don't like, you know. Now, Netflix is looking to make money, and that's what they're going to do, right? Or Paramount, like whoever ends up with this thing. But for now, it seems like Netflix has got it. It seems like Netflix has got it in the bag. So we'll see. I don't know. Keep it on Allscripts for more. I feel like I need to get a master's in business or something.
MBA to talk about movies.
Good God. Anyway, let's get back to talking about real movies. All right. This particularly film on Netflix. This weekend that we watched. I'm going to take the summary on this, so please excuse me, funny delivery. The movie is Jay Kelly. So, Jay Kelly is a kind of all-American Hollywood star in his 60s. And as he's getting up there in his years, and he's getting a little bit tired of making pictures, and the people who kind of helped him get up to where he's at in his life are getting out of the industry, some even dying, Jay finds that it's a time of reflection in his life, that maybe he wants to take a pause from his next project, go to France, and look back on his life. And that's where we find George Clooney in Jay Kelly, the new Netflix feature written and directed by Noah Baumbach. George is Jay in kind of the literal sense. Jay Kelly's life very much echoes George Clooney's life. He very much has the shape of a Hollywood star who is beloved everywhere he goes, no matter what country he's in, no matter what part of the city or state or township. Like, everybody knows who Jay Kelly is, and they see their life through his life, his performances. And over the course of the feature, Jay and his beloved manager, Ron, played by Adam Sandler, kind of step back into these set pieces of this aging actor's life, very literally through these wonderful kind of transitions shot by Linus Sandgren, the cinematographer behind Saltburn, worked with Noah Baumbach on this feature. We get these kind of look backs, these little set pieces of Jay looking back at how things were and his relationship with his daughters and kind of where he's at now. And ultimately, as the film builds towards this a tribute in Tuscany, I think for Jay that he's got, it's up to him to kind of figure out, has he used his life effectively, being rich and famous and being the thing everybody wants? Is this truly the way he's meant to live, or should he be doing something different? The movie is Jay Kelly. It's on Netflix now. Andy and I took a look at it. Andy, what do you think of Jay Kelly?
So this movie had a lot of buzz coming out of the festivals, but it's kind of gotten more of a mixed reception more recently. So I kind of could not stand this movie. I could not get into it. Tell me if you've heard this one. Successful patriarch looks back on his life with regret. We actually saw this last week. with sentimental value, which it's kind of the, it's very similar setup, exact same setup. A successful patriarch in the film business looks back on his life with regret. That movie does it a lot better as far as the reconciliation of his life. I just couldn't really get into it. I couldn't get into J. Kelly himself as a charming actor. He's kind of insufferable. And he's like, oh no, my life is like, I've been so successful, but I don't really have the family connections that now feel a little bit important to me. I couldn't get on board with Adam Sandler's character, Ron, who I think you're supposed to be able to feel very sympathetic for. He's abandoning his own family to be at J. Kelly's side and is kind of a shifty guy himself. I don't know. There's been Oscar talk for this performance, and I was like, it's fine. I don't think it's Oscar worthy. I just couldn't get into it. It's too long. Like, I had to watch this in parts, and it's a little bit over 2 hours. It's not like it's a 3 hour movie, but it was just a little insufferable. I couldn't get into it. I appreciate the themes that of this, like, you know, looking back on a life and what's really important. I feel like we've seen this done so many times, and this is just one of, it's not the best that it's been done. Like I said, way better last week in sentimental value. So I'm pretty cold on it so far.
So good news, J. Kelly fans. I'm a little warmer than Andy is on it. I definitely think J. Kelly has problems, but overall, I think I liked it. I think J. Kelly is kind of a feather in the cap for George Clooney. It's a big performance from him. And like I said, the character is very much in the shape of George Clooney's life, albeit a kind of a workaholic. Jay has two daughters, one from a divorce from his previous marriage, the other who he kind of still talks to, but is leaving for college at the end of the summer, right? So he's got one more summer to spend with her. And he finds out at the beginning of the movie that she is going to France for this big trip. And he wants to tag along and come with. Why not, right? And she's like, Dad, you're Jay Kelly. Everybody knows who you are. That's impossible, right? And realizing that time is escaping him, he takes a chance meeting at a bar with a local college friend of his, where he kind of has this, like, played by Billy Crudup, and he kind of has this moment of reflection where he's kind of approached about the situation, this like troubling thing in his past. And that those two events kind of kickstart him being like, I'm hitting the road. And he tells his manager, Adam Sandler, who's trying to make this like tennis match with his kid, like this goofy Adam Sandler subplot that's like supposed to be important, he's supposed to be a parent, and then he's going to France and that Ron's got to come with him, and that's what they're doing, right? So Ron is trying to kind of keep up with him throughout the movie. And, like, the problem is, I think they get to France, they hop on this train, and this is where the movie hits the brakes. This is where we get out of the first act and into act two, and this is where I was like, oh no, is this going to be a train movie the whole time? Are we just doing this? Like, at first it's like life and luxury in LA, and George Clooney's like got security around him, and he feels like he's alone all the time, even though everybody loves him. People are approaching him, can I get a photo? Like, all that stuff I was kind of into. But then you start to find out, like, the movie really slows down, and it ends up being like a kind of full 2 hour look at Jay's life with these like kind of clever, colorful set pieces where we step back in time with the young actor, and like, that stuff's fun, but like, it's just kind of long and dragged out in a way. And it's funny, cause I think the last Baumbach movie I watched was Marriage Story. And like, I like Marriage Story, but revisiting Marriage Story, like, also has similar kind of pacing problems. Like, it kind of, it starts to drag, you know, and like life, there are parts of it that are boring, and that's here too. Like it's not an action thriller, J. Kelly.
They are on this train so long, and it's a bit of a road trip movie. They're on the plane, they're on the train, they're in a car, they're in a buggy. I was like, when are we gonna, and it just kind of kept going. Some things that I do like is when J. Kelly is looking back and thinking about moments of his life, his conversation with Billy Crudup, they talk about that audition that he lost and J. Kelly won, and if he'd have won it, his life would have been totally different. And then J. Kelly walks through a door, and we get a flashback to the young versions of themselves and this event happening. And this happens several times through the movie. It reminded me a lot of A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey, actually, with the Colin Farrell, Margot Robbie film, kind of doing a little bit of the same things. These are interesting moments looking back, because the memories or the events are maybe a little bit different from how they were first relayed to us. And so we see him looking back to moments in other life with his wife, his daughters, and kind of seeing, well, maybe I should have done this or that differently. So I like some of the stylistic things. But man, yeah, just the pacing is real bad in the middle of it. I was kind of with it for the first hour, like you said.
Yeah, like, what? Like, how do you, does the man who have everything has everything like truly have everything, or is he lacking? I really like a lot of the parenting stuff in here. Both of these are parenting movies, Hamnet and Jake Kelly. We didn't talk about it a lot in Hamnet, but it is, and this is a parenting movie too, because you know he's got these two daughters and he struggles to kind of maintain relationships with them, especially the older one who's from his first marriage. And he struggles to spend time with her effectively. And there's a really great scene in the middle of the movie where he kind of has a flashback. We want to see her at this kooky therapist. And she says, you know, Dad, you know how I know you didn't want to spend time with me? Because you didn't spend time with me. And it's a great Baumbach line. And it's a great Baumbach scene. Like, and feels very emotional and raw. And it's true, right? Like, while Jay Kelly was globetrotting the world, chasing his career and fame and fortune and going to the next great film project where he's going to have fun and live life and discover art, like, he had a kid who was, like, growing up without a father. And that's wrong. And, like, nearly every parent in Jay's arsenal here, everybody that works with him, is also a parent. Like, Sandler's a parent who is missing out on his kid's thing. And his wife's calling him with, like, 9 things going wrong on the phone. And Laura Dern plays his kind of, like, I don't want to say costume designer, fashion consultant. Publicist. The person who puts his fits together, right? And she also is a parent and she's like, oh yeah, my kid's not at his soccer game or whatever. And it's fine. And then like, he's got Emily Mortimer, who actually co-wrote the script with Baumbach, is his hairdresser. She falls off early in act one, cause she books another gig and can't make it. But she mentions like, she's a parent and she's not around for her kid. And it's like all these people who are choosing Hollywood and movie making over raising a family and really maybe living. Right? Like maybe actually living life and not just working all the time. And because of its like allegiance to Hollywood and that like behind the scenes stuff, I think that's part of the reason it gets a lot of Oscar buzz. I think it's part of the reason people are like, oh man, this is a movie maker's movie for sure. For sure. And there's a great scene at the end with this wonderful tribute scene, like, and a lot of like footage, but a lot of footage of Clooney, but like, it's also long and it's, you know, full, it's a very full movie. And I think it makes it tough to sit down and watch in one go on Netflix, where in theaters, I think it would have played better.
So these flashbacks, or when he's looking back on his life and thinking, you know, I wish I would have trying to reconnect with his daughters and things, that's balanced by or juxtaposed by Jay Kelly being famous and being successful. And when he's on this road trip through Italy, he's on just a normal person train. He's not in first class, like they don't have a first class cabin, and he's like rubbing elbows with the everyday man, and they love and adore him. They are swooning. They're like, oh, Jay Kelly, I watched you, my mom watched you, my grandmother watched you, and they're like fawning over him, and he loves it. And I think that is a little bit of an interesting part, is while he's regretful of the life he didn't have, he's still in love with the life that he does. He's in love with being a movie star, with being this kind of fake character to these people. And despite him having fewer and fewer people that mean anything around him, he still loves the limelight. And that's kind of an interesting idea. The subplots are a little weird. Again, the Laura Dern character and her and Sandler have a weird semi-romance, and they talk about the being at the Eiffel Tower. I was like, what are we doing here? How, yeah. Where did this come from? Sandler does have a really kind of intense scene there. But I was also like, I had heard Oscar buzz about Adam Sandler, and I was like, he's got like 2 good scenes. The rest of it is he's like playing himself. The other thing about his character is he calls everyone puppy in a very like endearing way. Like whenever Jay Kelly's like, man, Fletcher, he's like, oh, we got it, puppy. We're going to get that deal. We're going to, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm here for you. And then when he meets with his other client, he's always like, says, I'm here, puppy. So I found like Sandler to be really kind of despicable as a character. And I think you're supposed to be sympathetic for him. And like, I just absolutely am not.
Yeah, I mean that's part of what I've found so interesting. I think that's kind of the magic here, like that's lays itself bare by the end of the film. Like Sandler is this kind of funhouse mirror reflection of Jay Kelly, right? He's a father who's actively not present for his kids and family. He even has 2 kids, just like Jay Kelly does, right? Like, and he's actively choosing work and this stuff over him. And like, you just find out over the course of the movie that like, he's not, I don't know. Like, I think he's supposed to be a hero. Like, I think we're supposed to be pulling for him. But yeah, I was like, this guy sucks. Like, he's not a good, like, kind of not a good guy. He's not being a good father. He's not being a very good manager. He's supposed to be his friend. And like, that's kind of clunky. Like, I don't know if Sandler's just miscast or what happened there, but it's like, I think that the Sandler B plot did not work that good for me, but I was charmed by Kelly. You mentioned that scene when he gets on the train. Like, I, I love when Jay Kelly gets on the train and everybody's looking at him and everybody's like, oh my God, can I get an autograph? And he's kind of looking past people and he just sees in each seat like 100 little movies. You know what I mean? He sees like a mom and a daughter sharing like a set of earbuds listening to music, or like a woman and her husband like arguing about something, or an old lady eating like cucumber sandwiches. You know what I mean? Like this music just kind of twinkles in, and like I don't know. I was charmed by Kelly. Clooney got me. This is a Clooney performance that I was pulled in by. Like whereas you were turned off by it, like I kind of came around on Kelly. I ultimately kind of liked him, and I like these larger messages, these themes of like, are you using your time effectively? You know, it reminds me of It's a Wonderful Life, right? George Bailey, like, what did I do it right? Or was it all wrong? I saw the TV glow. Also reminded me a bit of, because it's a road movie and it's overseas and on a train a bit, it reminded me of A Real Pain. You remember that movie, Jesse Eisenberg?
Yeah.
Yeah, like a lot of like traveling and like, yeah, we're doing it in style, you know? It's like fun, I guess, some outdoor stuff. Anyway, we should wrap it up. Any thoughts on Jay Kelly for recommendations?
I want to mention that there's a lot of cameos in this movie that I will not spoil. This was a little bit of an interesting thing, like with Billy Crudup, because we've already mentioned him. We hear him reference this character a lot, and then we see the character, and we're like, oh, it's well-known actor Billy Crudup. That happens multiple times through the film, which I thought was kind of a fun thing, because they reference someone a lot, and then that person shows up, and you're like, oh, I didn't know they were in this movie. I thought that was a fun touch. Some people are kind of annoyed by that. That was one of the few things I liked about the movie.
I'm sorry. Yeah, good celebrity cameos. Big asset in any Noah Baumbach feature, I think. Yeah, all right. Well, Andy, would you recommend Jay Kelly?
I'm going to say soft pass on this. I was really lukewarm. It's a little bit too long, and it's very cliche in the successful older film star looks back on his life with regret. Woe is me. He tries to reconcile with his family. We've seen this movie a lot, but done much better. Like I said, last week with Sentimental Value. Performances are pretty good. They're not as Oscar worthy as people have been talking. Like it's way too long. It's a little charming. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, I'm a little warmer on it. I think George Clooney's a lot of fun in this movie. If you like George Clooney, I think you're going to like Jay Kelly. A little long, though. Do your laundry while you're watching Jay Kelly. You know what I mean? Throw it on Netflix and, you know, do your taxes or something. Kind of have it, because you can pay attention to the important stuff, and then you can kind of tune out when something happens that you're not super into. It's a good feature. It's not quite a great one, but it's a lot of good George Clooney, and that's important because I like George. George is great. And yeah. That's Off Script episode 318. Good Lord, Andy. We are coming up on the end of the year, and we haven't talked about it a lot, but we got to figure out our holiday scheduling. We're doing some math just before we hopped on here. I think we kind of got it. What are we watching next week, Andy?
So next week for December 16th, we are watching Ella McKay, which is out this Friday, December 12th. This is a new copy by James L. Brooks. I think it's based on a novel. Heard a lot of buzz about it. Don't really know too much, but we're going to be checking it out. We're also going to be checking it out, possibly Die My Love, which is on Apple or VOD. We're going to leave that open. We might choose something else. Some FYI releases. Wake Up Dead Man is, of course, the big Netflix release, which we got to see early, but that's going to be out this Friday. So if you haven't seen that, that'll be out on Netflix. Some other VOD. Christie, the boxing movie with Sydney Sweeney, is that on VOD. Keeper, which we reviewed last week, and also The Carpenter's Son, all available to rent this weekend. And upcoming, Avatar Fire and Ash and Marty Supreme. Next week, I think it's time for our top 10 lists.
Oh, boy. Well, good, because I was just working on mine the other night, actually. Dude, it's a stacked year. stacked year for
it
top
really
10
is.
Lists. Good Lord. If you enjoyed the show today, if you want to check out our review of Wake Up Dead Man and Knives Out Mystery, it's on the channel. That'll go live on Netflix, like Andy said, this weekend, if you haven't seen it. But if you are interested, go see it in a theater. That movie plays good in a theater. It's a good time. It's in some theaters. See if it's in one near you. You should totally check it out. After you check out our spoiler-free review, of course, if you like what we're doing here on Off Script, the best way to support us is to just subscribe to the channel, subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to whatever. Hit the like and review and the comment and just engage with us in some fashion. It helps us big in the algo, I promise. The almighty algorithm in the sky loves it when people click on stuff, loves when people watch stuff and click on stuff and subscribe to stuff and hit the notification bell stuff. All that helps us. So if you like the show, check us out on YouTube where we post new clips every week. Check out our website, offscriptfilmview.com. You can email us correspondence directly, mail@offscriptfilmview.com. all the usual social media places, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. You can check out the audio version of the show on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, iHeartMedia. You might have been listening there right now. And if you are, thanks. Hey, do us a solid. Leave us a rating and review, especially if you've listened before. Come on. It really mean a lot. And yeah, that's Off Script episode 318. From all of us at Off Script, home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.